stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts for the power, performance, and reliability of a new Superstart battery. Visit O'ReillyAuto.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
You found us again. This is Matt Tebbe. This is the Gravity Commons Podcast. I'm co-hosting today with my good friend and overall great person, Christy Penley. Hello, Christy. Aww.
Hello, that was so kind of you. Thank you.
Well, we've been good friends for a long time.
We have.
I got to actually see you.
Like, we did just this past weekend.
36 hours ago or something.
Yes, it was so fun. It was fast and quick, but so good.
Yeah, so Ben and I were at Theology Beer Camp, and I will say that I've been to so many, quote, conferences in my life, and this one was the perfect mix of, like, really challenging, unique voices from the platform who were maybe saying things I hadn't heard before, or maybe even disagreed with, but in a way that was like, consider this. And everybody's like, all right, let's consider that, which is kind of a unique sort of posture, right?
Yeah.
And then I got to meet a lot of people. So I met some of you listening. I met you for the first time at this Theology Beer Camp. And it was great to put sometimes just faces with, you know, some people I meet on social media, they have like a picture of a Greek icon as their PFP. And so, you know, oh, that's who that is, you know? And so it was great. So it was a good balance of like really challenging platform speakers, great workshops. And then I missed half of the platform sessions because I would stop in the hallway and be like, oh, hey, you, I haven't seen you for 10 years. And then we'd sit down and chat. So.
So good.
Yeah. It was great. And
then we got to have dinner because I didn't go to that. I didn't get to join you guys on Thursday and Friday. I had my own conference that I went to.
Actually, tell us about it.
Colorado Springs. It was put on by Fuller Seminary, and it was called Ministering in a Messy World. And so they just talked about like kind of all the mess, all the junk that's kind of going on, and how do we navigate that, and how do we be honest about what's really going on in our world, whether that's politically or war or just all these issues that are happening. So it was good. It was, it was well worth the time. So, but it meant that I missed you guys. So we just got to get dinner on Friday, which was so fun.
Yeah.
Not great food or service, but so fun.
Yes. It wasn't great food or service. That's right. But, but we did, I always enjoy hanging out with you and Paul, and that was, I've seen Paul twice in 6 weeks.
I know.
I may not see him again for another 6 months. So, anyway, well, our conversation today is with a friend of mine who I've had a chance of hanging out with several times, Joel Bowman Sr. And we're talking about Christian faith and politics. Now, let me just say something real quick here. I know we're on the cusp of the national presidential election here in several weeks. And Gravity Commons, one of the things we do is we host learning communities, which are weekly 75-minute online Zoom conversations around a certain topic. And so we've done the gospel that Jesus preached. We've done healing prayer. And we're going to start one here in the next week or two on faith and politics. And in particular, it's going to wrap around the election. And in particular, we're going to talk about what would a Christian politic look like if it's not MAGA. Let's just say it's not MAGA. Maybe we need something else on the shelf other than the MAGA box.
Yes.
To imagine what it would look like to have a faith that's engaged in the public square. So we're going to talk about things like how did we get to MAGA, the history behind that, and what animates it. We're going to talk about what is politics, right? What is politics? Because I think we use that word a lot, and we have definitions or assumptions in mind, and I want to challenge some of those. And then we're going to look at what does political engagement look like in the scriptures, and then we're going to talk through how would we describe a more faithful Christian political engagement or political theology or political ethic. And so, and then finally, how do we, you know, no matter who wins in a few weeks, if it's Kamala Harris or if it's Donald Trump, I feel like there's going to be some kind of like your conference said, Chrissy, some kind of mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
we need to know, how are we going to respond?
How do we ready our bodies for action, as Paul says? How do we become people who can be good news in a world that most likely will have some freaking out here in several weeks? So we'll put a link in the show notes on how you can get to that. I think it's going to be a 7-week class. If you join, if you become a premium member of the Commons, $25 a month, you get access to that class and that learning community and so much more. If you've been looking for a way to support us, that's a great way to support us, to just build a monthly membership base so that we can continue to develop content, continue to do podcasts, et cetera. Or you can pay one off. So we don't want money to keep anybody away. So if you just want to come to the first class, you can donate what you want and come to the first learning community and see if it's for you and see if you vibe with the people there. We have some great people. I think you will vibe with them.
Yes, you will.
But look for that in the show notes, and then we'll start that here in the next several weeks. But the conversation today is about political witness and political engagement. And I think it's, I'm just excited to, Joel's been on the podcast before, and I'm excited to share our conversation with you. Real quick, Reverend Joel A. Bowman Sr. is a native of, a proud native of Detroit, Michigan, and he holds a Bachelor of Social Work and a Master of Social Work from Wayne State University. And he also graduated from the Michigan Theological Seminary. And since 2001, he served as founder and senior pastor of the Temple of Faith Baptist Church in South Louisville. He's also a licensed clinical social worker. Currently, he's a therapist with the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, providing mental health treatment to America's military veterans. Joel has written for a number of online magazines and publications. You can find his writing, his work, and how to contact him at his website, acompellingvoice.com. Let's get into this conversation with Joel. Reverend Joel A. Bowman Sr., welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Hey, Matt, what's going on?
It's good to see you, man. It's good to be with you. Joel, we're in this, doing this series as we lead up to the election, the presidential election of 2024, and trying to cultivate, foment conversations about politics that avoid some of the unfortunate, I think, habits or pitfalls that Christians often get into. And so I appreciate you joining us today unto that endeavor. Maybe by way of introduction, would you give us a brief sketch of sort of your bona fides as a Christian, you know, your upbringing and your Christian tradition and like where you're coming from?
Yeah, so I was raised in a Christian home. Both my parents were highly engaged in church, and I cannot talk about my spiritual formation without referring to my parents, because that's where I first learned about Christ, and then they took me to church. And our home church for many, many years had been the Second Baptist Church of Detroit. It is historical in that it is the oldest African-American congregation in the Midwest, not just in the state, but in the Midwest. Wow. And in fact, Second Baptist is so steeped with history as it relates to both the abolitionist movement as well as the civil rights movement. So you had persons like Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, John Brown had all had meetings hosted by Second Baptist. And you probably have heard about Harper's Ferry and John Brown. Well, the planning meeting for that was hosted by Second Baptist Church. One of the last stops on the Underground Railroad before you get to Canada, which was also known as Canaan Land, was there at Second Baptist. All right. And so when enslaved persons would sing songs like "I'm on my way to Canaan Land," that would oftentimes be a euphemism for Canada, that it's time to escape, it's time to run to Canada. But in terms of my Christian bona fides, yeah, raised by a Christian couple, I accepted Christ as my Lord and personal Savior at the age of 12 on September 28th, 1980. I know my salvation date, all right? So I've got bona fides. And yep. Then I was baptized a week after that at the Second Baptist Church. Interestingly, Second Baptist also hosted Dr. King. I believe I sent you a text of when our late pastor, Dr. A.A. Banks Jr., had invited Dr. King to come and to preach. Yeah. And also, let me say that Ralph Bunche, Dr. Ralph Bunche, who was the first African-American to get a Nobel Peace Prize, was baptized at Second Baptist. And so, again, this is a church steeped in tradition, steeped in history, and so many different luminaries, like I said, from the abolitionist movement to the civil rights movement, have gone through Second Baptist. And it's been my honor to have preached my first sermon there at Second. I acknowledged my call to ministry and was licensed as a Baptist preacher in 1994 in that same pulpit in which people like Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King Jr. stood.
Man, that's incredible, Joel. That kind of lineage, that heritage, you know, it goes back, what, 150, 200 years?
Nearly 200. The church was founded in 1836 by 13 formerly enslaved persons. And one more thing about Second Baptist you need to know is that Dr. King sent a letter of thanks to the pastor and the church at that time because they were the largest, the biggest financial contributor to the Montgomery bus boycott.
Wow. Yeah. So with all that, and we didn't even go into the fact that now you live in Louisville, you're right. You're a social worker and you're also have been a pastor in Louisville there at the church that, another Baptist church there in Louisville.
Yes.
My question is maybe as we reflect together on, you know, we're a couple months away from the election, maybe less than a couple months, the presidential election. What are some of the things that you're noticing, storylines that you're watching? And I guess then maybe connecting your upbringing at Second Baptist Church in Detroit, like how do you feel like the spiritual formation that you received as a kid, as a young man, as a young pastor, how does that influence or shape what you notice, what you think is significant here in this election?
Well, there are two things, two storylines that I notice in particular, the first of which is obviously the mercurial rise of Kamala Harris since President Biden stepped out of the race and endorsed her, and she's been nominated by the Democratic Party. It has been incredible to see how much money has been raised and how much enthusiasm there has been. And I likened it to the first time that President Obama ran for office, that he had created, as it were, a movement of persons who were willing to support him. And so this is the first time that I have sensed that kind of enthusiasm since Obama. The second piece has to do with the slow trickle of Republicans who are endorsing Harris.
Yeah.
You know, persons like Adam Kinzinger and more recently Liz Cheney. You know, these are bona fide conservative Republicans. And when I use the term conservative, I'm using it in its classical sense rather than its Trumpist sense, right? So when we talk about conservatism, we're talking about, you know, fiscal conservatism and also some social conservatism as well. But to see that happening, more and more Republicans coming out publicly and saying that, you know, we are voting for Kamala Harris, that has been very, very interesting to view. In reference to the second part of your question, you know, how has my church background at Second Baptist influenced how I see all of these things. I think it's fundamental because I grew up in a tradition, in a church, in which there was a distinct theology of social justice. You know, it is impossible for anyone to have been raised in that church and missed that. It was in the air that we breathe that we believe that all human beings are created in God's image and are to be treated with equity. And so that was a core value of that church, you know, with all of its history. And so I grew up with the assumption that, well, I guess most Christians have this view. You know, I had some degree of naivete until my freshman year at Wayne State University in Detroit, which was in 1986. I got involved with Campus Crusade for Christ, which, as you know, is one of the largest parachurch ministries on the planet. And as I got involved with Campus Crusade, I saw that I had certain things in common with the white students involved in that movement. And a high view of scripture would be one, a belief in the deity of Christ, the doctrine of the Trinity, all of those things we had in common. However, where there was a distinct parting of the ways was as it related to how we apply our faith to politics. And it just so happens that most of my white counterparts, they had political views that were in perfect alignment with the Republican Party. And so that was kind of like culture shock to me. And it was very disconcerting because these same individuals clearly had no theology of social justice. In fact, you know, they had this belief that if someone was heavy into social justice, that means they're into the social gospel, they're liberals, or whatever else, you know. So, yeah, my social justice upbringing at Second Baptist is really the lens through which I see both faith and politics. It is impossible for me to divorce the two.
We'll be right back. The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, that maybe is what stood out to me as you went down the litany of people, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the people who you know, were associated with your church that you were raised in, is that there, I think oftentimes in the white evangelical imagination, we are able to bifurcate or separate faith and politics, that they're two different realms, two different things. I'm reading a book by a white evangelical who's really anti-Trump, really offended and blindsided by MAGA. But the way he talks about the problem with MAGA is that it's it is the problem of being too into politics. So the problem he identifies with MAGA is these people take politics more seriously than Jesus. Mm-hmm. And what I'm struck by that framing, Joel, is that so you tell me, when you hear that framing, how do you respond to that framing?
Well, I respond to it by saying that that's quite a bit different from a traditional Black Christian view. Yeah. We see politics as an arena through which we can express our faith and apply our faith and apply our understanding of Scripture as it pertains to social justice and other issues. And so when we talk about being, quote unquote, too political, what I find with most white evangelicals, they kind of speak out of both sides of their mouth as it relates to that, in the sense that from one perspective, they say we ought not get too involved with politics. Ultimately, God is in control. He's sovereign. He will put into office whomever he wants, right? Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden in 2008, when God, quote unquote, put Obama into office, then there was very few prayers that I saw being lifted up by white evangelicals for the president. And furthermore, they did not continue to say that God put Obama in office. It just so happens that they have no problem saying God put this conservative Republican in office or this right-wing ideologue in office. Yeah, yeah. But they have a real problem with Democrats being the result of God's sovereignty. So I think even though a lot of white evangelicals may say that politics is not that important, I think that politics, particularly right-wing conservatism, has become so conflated with the white evangelical movement that many of those folks have lost the ability to discern the difference between the two. They're so merged in terms of their nomenclature, the language that they use, in terms of their, you know, theological and sociological framework, that your friend, for instance, may not even recognize the extent to which he has incorporated, you know, and merged his politics with his theology. So I think it's a little double speak that's going on sometimes, not necessarily in regards to your friend, but I see it. In fact, I recently saw it with a former neighbor of mine, is a friend of mine on Facebook, and she is a Trump Republican. And, you know, out of one side of her mouth, she says, well, Joel, we ought not be so focused on the election because God is in control. But on the other side of the perspective, she's saying, well, if you want to be biblical in how you vote, you need to vote for Trump, because after all, the Republican Party is the party of pro-life. And so therefore, you know, anyone that's voting for the Democratic Party is sadly misled. So there's there's some doublespeak going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if we can double click on that a little bit. You know, you mentioned your upbringing at that church, there was a focus on social justice. But then, like, the other factor that you just mentioned was that there is a pretty stark divide between the way that, just broadly speaking, like maybe a Black person who has a more conservative theology and a white person who has a more conservative theology. There's a very stark difference in how they vote.
Indeed.
You know, and so I think the stats, at least the ones that we looked up recently, were like the Black people voted 92% for Biden versus Trump in 2020. And then Black Christians were 91% for Biden. And then, you know, this is a famous stat. I mean, white evangelicals went overwhelmingly 81%. For Trump. Yeah. Or 84%, you know, depending on, I think, how you're counting it all. But anyway, I wonder if we can talk about why, like what is the reason, do you think, for that discrepancy among people who, you know, share a lot of commonalities in terms of how they view the scriptures? Maybe. Yeah. The theology is the same. Like what's the deal there?
Yeah. I think the deal has to do with, how each of those two groups of people view politics as it relates to the populace as a whole. So the one thing that white evangelicals and Black Christians have in common is that they both see their faith as at least informing their politics or their political decisions, and at best shaping their politics. But the critical difference is that because most Black Christians are coming from a social justice framework, the focus is on what political decisions can I make such that more people can be included in the American dream, right? Mm. Whereas white evangelicals have very much an exclusivistic view in terms of how can we win the culture wars? You know, how can we make it so that our particular version of Christianity is privileged over every other religious tradition in the country? So the Black social justice tradition within the church has always focused on inclusion rather than exclusion. And the white evangelical tradition, particularly since the late 70s, has really focused on exclusion as it pertains to who has power in this country.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of riff on that a little bit, that difference then is based on kind of traditionally and historically where the power has been located, right? So those with the cultural and economic and political power have tended to vote for the sort of ensconcing of that power, the maintenance of that power, the consolidating of that power. And those who've been outside of it sort of understand, like, hey, we need to, you know, like this needs to be more inclusive. This power, this freedom, this flourishing needs to be expanded.
And, that's right.
You know, we know that because we've been outside of it. And so we're voting for that to be expanded.
Yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Joel.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that described as like a liberative framework versus a supremacist framework.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
You know, and what I mean by supremacist is there has to be somebody on top or at the center.
Mm-hmm. There's a hierarchy.
And the hierarchy affords the people at the top or the center with privileges that others don't have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, just reflecting on this for a moment, I think this is why oftentimes people, you know, it's been said that like losing privilege feels like persecution. Mm-hmm. You know, when you no longer have the benefits that others don't, and now they get your benefits, it feels like you're under attack.
Mm-hmm. It feels like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you brought up before this concept of pro-life, and let's talk about it, because I think in the last year or so, it's really become fascinating to focus on. This is one of the storylines I'm following in this election. You know, you have the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade, which seems like it's been almost 50-year plan for some people, right? And Donald Trump then seemingly flip-flopping on pro-life issues, right? Going back and forth between supporting a federal ban and no, and being for, you know, in vitro and then not, and then supporting 6-week legislation and then not supporting it. And a lot of our listeners, I mean, I wasn't like this, but a lot of our listeners grew up with seeing politics as black and white, no pun intended, but black and white around pro-life, right? You vote for the candidate who speaks out the strongest against abortion. Mm-hmm. That's what it means to be a Christian who's politically engaged in national politics. Mm-hmm. talk us through how that single issue from your perspective is insufficient, and and why is that not a compelling public ethic in general, in general, for the Black Christian church?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, Matt, Donald Trump is not a quote-unquote pro-life ideologue. He never has been. In fact, he declared himself to be pro-choice years ago. So I think that his stance and his bringing on those three extremely conservative justices was really a part of his desire to obtain power and sustain power rather than, you know, carrying out or fulfilling some transcendent principle of his. So that's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, I think that the whole one issue piece is inadequate for most Black Christians because we see the hypocrisy and the racism on the other side. We see individuals who claim to be pro-life when they're actually anti-abortion. And the fundamental difference is they're against, you know, free lunches for kids that live in impoverished areas. They are against health care being accessible to all people. They are for deregulation of large corporations who oftentimes will have a lot of environmental pollutants in urban areas, in Black areas. And so you have environmental racism. They are the same people who will always come up with excuses for the police when they brutalize Black bodies, right? They are people who are, if they're not silent on the issue of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor at all, they are speaking out directly against them as if to say they brought this on themselves, that they are somehow complicit in their own deaths. And so we see the great hypocrisy there and how it's really not a holistic pro-life ethic. And see, most Black Christians with which I fellowship and partner, they have a holistic view of life, you know, from the womb to the tomb, that you know, many of us would agree that life begins at conception. However, we would extend that life, you know, far beyond the womb to, you know, that Black child that's growing up in an urban neighborhood that is impoverished, that has been disadvantaged in so many different ways. You know, how can we extend life to that person, right? And we understand that there is a direct connection between extending life to that person and certain political policies, which are either congruent with that or the antithesis of that. So a lot of folks who call themselves pro-life seem to be on the wrong side of history, on the wrong side of the aisle, as it pertains to looking at life holistically and the flourishing of persons of color.
Yeah. Yeah. And just taking, even if you want to talk about abortion, I know you know this, but abortion tends to go down under Democratic presidents. The rate tends to go
up.
It
does.
Or it goes down less quickly under GOP presidents.
It does.
And then something that I don't know if anybody anticipated, probably somebody did, but I didn't anticipate, is that the abortion rate has gone up after the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
Not surprising. Not surprising. Yeah. In fact, it was the abortion rate, I believe, was the lowest in history since Roe v. Wade under the Obama administration. The very person that many white evangelicals want to demonize and vilify, it was under his administration that there were fewer abortions than ever since Roe v. Wade. That's a major piece that we have to see.
And you mentioned this, the holistic life, you know, womb to tomb kind of thing. And I was reminded of this. I know you heard about the shooting in Georgia, the high school. And the governor is repeating the often repeated phrase that we hear from people who follow the NRA talking points.
Thoughts and prayers.
Which is, I mean, you know, he basically, the refrain is, this isn't the time to talk about safety or policy. We need thoughts and prayers. And if you press it, then you get accused of politicizing a child's murder. Right?
Right.
And that rhetoric that this isn't the time to talk about rectifying the wrong that just happened seems so asinine.
It is.
And I think is it's another reveal that something else is running the show. I mean, pro-life is the banner over it, but really what's running the show is like these kids. We protect our unfettered access to guns more than we want to protect our kids.
And also in the thinking of a lot of Republican politicians is we're protecting our financial interest. And
yeah, say more about that.
Yeah, so basically, when you look at many of the Republicans on the national leadership area, they are being bankrolled to a large extent by the NRA, by the gun lobby, right? And so there's really, in their thought process, no incentive to crack down on access to guns, to crack down on how the gun dealers are being regulated, because that's going into their own pockets. And so really this whole thing has been a ruse, if you will. It's been a cover for their own power mongering and their desire to have money. And they dress it up with spiritual language, theological language, you know, thoughts and prayers, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is that they have prioritized access to guns above the safety of our children. And a lot of it has been tied to power and money. In fact, most of it has been tied to power and money.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
I remember, you know, after that young man who, by all appearances, was a MAGA NRA person trying to assassinate former President Donald Trump. The response from MAGA wasn't to hand out more guns to make his rallies safer.
Okay.
When Donald Trump's life was threatened, the narrative wasn't, you know, the only way to stop that young man with a gun is to give all the good guys guns too.
Mm-hmm.
No, what happened was bulletproof glass was put up in front of Trump.
Right.
But those same people who decide to put up bulletproof glass in front of Trump want to give guns to teachers. Right. And so the logic is diseased in that it's pivoting around ideology rather than principle.
Right. Yeah.
Man, I get a little cranked up about that, Joel.
You and me both. You and me both.
All right. Well, let's talk about maybe we can kind of slowly begin to wrap up by talking about I spent 25 years in conservative white evangelical spaces. I'm now on a mainline white space that has some conservatives, but has more progressive white Christians. And what I hear from my friends who are anti-MAGA. But what I hear them saying one of two things to respond to MAGA. The antidote to MAGA is, number one, we just need to focus on Jesus, right? And the second is, I've already mentioned, the problem is that MAGA is making an idol of politics. The real problem is idolatry. And so then what happens is that, and I think I sent you a little text on this like a month ago, right? Those who support Trump and those who support Harris are putting too much hope in the world. And what needs to happen? And so then Harris supporters and Trump supporters are falling for the same, are in the same trap, falling for the same bait, right? They're making an idol of politics.
Right.
And what we need to do is make Jesus great. Because the kingdom is not of this world, Joel.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So if someone were to say, hey, this is how I think about things, can you help me? What am I missing? What's missing in that way of seeing my faith in politics? How would you help them see what's missing?
Well, I would say to them that Jesus is already great. I don't have to make him great. Okay. He's already famous. I don't need to make him famous. Okay. But I think that such a person would be drawing a false equivalency, because on the one hand, you have a Democratic politician in Kamala Harris who is about the rule of law, who is about the maintenance of American democracy and our democratic norms. And on the other end, you have a man who is clearly only for himself. He is highly narcissistic, and he is hoping that he will be the autocrat that runs this country, and that presidential power is centralized in such a way to take power away from the people. You know, so I think that such a person would be guilty of drawing a false equivalency. The other piece is that when we look at idolatry, you know, idolatry is when you conflate the image of Trump with the image of Jesus, right? We don't see that on the Democratic side. You know, what we see on the Democratic side largely are people who are concerned about our democracy being taken from us. And thus you have Republicans, even conservative ideologues, who are coming over to Kamala Harris's side because they see the bigger picture. You know, this is not so much a struggle between Democrats and Republicans. It is a struggle between those who love democracy and want to keep it, and those who want an autocracy in America, those who actually are very fascistic in their view.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, man, as you're saying that, Joel, part of the problem with the propaganda is that it's MAGA that's accusing Harris of being a fascist, a Nazi. You know, she's a communist. She, you know, and
that's laughable. And it
is. And then when I look at people and I say, you know, January 6th, like any of these things that have happened, I mean, today, the day we're talking, the Department of Justice released a report that $20 million of Russian money was being funneled into an alt-right news agency to spread Russian propaganda by people who have millions and millions of followers.
Yeah.
And I just shared that, which would be the news blast of a year, 20 years ago. But I could share three more things that happened today that are almost as scandalous. And so we have this avalanche of what the heck is happening, right?
Yeah.
And you have the other side accusing you of what they themselves are doing.
That's called projection in mental health circles.
Thank you, mental health professional. Yes, it is called projection, which is a strategy, I think, of abusive authoritarian people.
Yeah.
But then when somebody hears me or you or Ben, gosh, can't get Ben to shut up about this. We hear Ben say something like, this isn't politics as usual. Donald Trump is a legitimate threat to our democracy.
Yeah.
They hear the boy who cried wolf. They say you are just as bad as the other side. They label immigrants animals, and you label Donald Trump a fascist. It's the same thing.
Which is really, again, very laughable, because when you look at what has happened to the Republican Party since Trump took it over, there has been, you know, a further corrupting of it. You know, I believe there's obviously corruption on both sides of the aisle, but specifically as relates to the GOP, there was a time that the GOP prided itself in terms of being anti-Russia or anti-communist or whatever, right? You know, they were always looking for the red boogeyman. But what has happened in the last 10 years is that you have more pro-Russia Republicans than we've ever seen. You know, people who outwardly embrace Putin. You know, we have, you know, Trump calling Putin a very, very intelligent man, right? A brilliant man or whatever words that he used in reference to Putin. So what we're seeing, again, as I indicated before, is a shift away from classical conservatism to fascism. You know, Trump is not a conservative, you know, in the traditional sense of that term. You know, he is a self-absorbed wannabe autocrat. I mean, when you look at all the folks that he looks up to, Erdogan and Putin and Ong, when you look at all those folks, they have what he wants. Mm-hmm. He wants to have the same thing in America. He talks about suspending the Constitution. Now, when is the last time you ever heard of some politician saying we need to suspend the Constitution? I would dare say you probably have never heard that. Mm-hmm. But yet we live in a day and age in which, you know, the Republican Party, which prided itself on being, you know, constitutionalist or originalist, right? Mm-hmm. You have a man who's in charge of that same party talking about the suspension of the Constitution. So that's clearly not conservative as what you and I grew up to understand conservatism to be.
Yeah.
Let those who have ears to hear.
Yeah.
Let them hear.
Yeah.
Let them hear. Joel, I appreciate your friendship, man. And I appreciate, you know what I appreciate is that I think that you help me stay hopeful. When I'm around you, you know, we've had the joy of spending breaking bread together multiple times and
yes.
talking about really difficult things. And I'm always impressed by your earthy, hard-fought hope. And so I just want to say that I value that, and I value you as a friend.
So, likewise, man.
You are a gifted writer, and I would love our audience to be able to read some of what you've written. Would you let us know where they can find that online?
Sure. They can find it on my website, acompellingvoice.com, acompellingvoice.com. I have a number of pieces I've written consolidated there. Also, I have various podcast appearances, like this one will be on the website. And I've got certain sermons. For instance, I have a sermon on a Christian perspective of police brutality that's on there. So yeah, they can follow me there, and they can also follow me at Joel A. Bowman Sr. on Twitter, or what is now called X.
Yeah.
At Joel A. Bowman Sr.
Well, Joel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
It's simple math. Tim Hortons 2-3-4 menu fills your mornings without emptying your pockets. $2 gets you a hot coffee or a classic bagel. $3, try a sausage and cheese English muffin or two classic donuts. And for $4, enjoy an egg and cheese croissant or an iced cap. Do the math. It all adds up to delicious deals. Only at Tim's. The Tim's 2-3-4 menu is available until 2 p.m. at select Columbus, Ohio restaurants. Terms apply.